Okay, so what we were doing last time was we wanted to have a face-based description of Wilson lines. So if you recall, a Wilson line is equal to a particle whose Hilbert space is a representation of the gauge group. So if M is a symplectic manifold, and we have G is the gauge group, and G acts on M, we expect that geometric quantization of M will give such a particle. So the idea is going to be, if I want to consider the phase space in the presence of a Wilson line, if I take a time slice, this is a Wilson line. The phase space is going to be roughly gauge theory phase space times M. This is only roughly, because they're coupled together in some way, but it'll be roughly like this. So there's a really fun and kind of beautiful game where you take your group and you build a symplectic manifold which will give you your chosen representation. This is called the Borel-Weber theorem. That's how you do this. So I'll just explain some examples for the groups U1 and the groups SU2. My gauge group is U1. We need M with a U1 action. So I can take, for example, I can take M to be OR2, where U1 acts by the Hamiltonian p squared plus q squared. So in other words, the U1 action is just the flows of the harmonic oscillator. Because this is periodic, this is indeed a U1 action. So the Hilbert space is going to be, as we saw before, the sum of the eigenstates of the harmonic oscillator. And these correspond to the Bohr semifold orbits if you recall the symplectic form is dp dq, so it's r du r d theta. The Bohr centrifold orbits are when r is an integer. Okay, so the U1 action is, of course, given by this Hamiltonian. So what this tells us is that the Hilbert space is a direct sum of the irreducible representations of U1, where U1 acts by n squared. Direct sum over n, C n squared, where C n squared is the irrep of U1 with charge n squared. Okay. So of course we can do other kinds of things. Or M is S1 times S1, and then U1 acts by P. Well, in this case, the Hilbert space, say omega, is like n dp dq. Space is n-dimensional. And of course, it's easy to see from our discussions before which representations appear in this. And it's the direct sum of c to the k, where k is not to n minus 1. So this is very simple. When we go to couple it to Trans-Simons theory, a key point to bear in mind is that if we have a state in this, on our Wilson line, it's going to correspond to a Lagrangian, where the Hamiltonian for the U1 action takes a particular value, and that value is the charge in that sector. Okay, any questions about this so far? Okay, the SU2 case is much more interesting. We take the Hilbert space. So we take M to be S2, the symplectic form to be times n. So I want to there's some factors of pi which I'm dropping here. So you normalize it so the area is around n. And to give an SU2 action, we need three Hamiltonian functions. Whose Poisson bracket is given by the algebra of polymatrices. Of course, we have these because SU2 is a double cover of SO3, and SO3 just acts by rotation of these three vectors. So by thinking about these symmetries, we're going to find such Hamiltonian functions. But if you think about it a little bit, is they're just the coordinate functions. So the polymatrix sigma I gets sent to xi, the coordinate functions, and So there's some normalization again. Dxi over. So where's the normalization going to be? Sorry, just getting the normalization right. This, the way I've written it, this will have a 1 over n in it. So, yeah, xi over n. And sum of xi squared is going to be like n squared. OK, so what this tells us is that quantization of S2 will give a representation of the group SU2. So to figure out what representation it is, we're going to apply geometric quantization and look at the Bohr-Sommerfeld orbits. And we'll assume, suppose the area is 1, then we take a polarization given by x1. So it looks like this. So we're just fibering the sphere over the interval by one of the coordinates. So to figure out the states in the Hilbert space, we need to figure out the Bohr-Sommerfeld orbits. Well, there's, well, these are Lagrangians, which have this special property. So it turns out there's only two of them in this case, and they correspond to the degenerate Lagrangians when x1 is minus 1 or x1 is 1. These are degenerate Lagrangians. These automatically satisfy the Bohr-Sommerfeld condition. Because the integral over the Lagrangian of alpha is just 0, just because the Lagrangian has collapsed to a point. So any integral is 0. Now, these, in fact, are the only states, because there's area 1, there's no, when I go from one Bohr-Sommerfeld orbit to the next one, I have to be fit unit area between them. And there's no room. So there's no room for other states. So we've built, by this procedure, we've sketched how to build a representation of SU2, which is two-dimensional. Well, of course, we know what this is. This is the spin half representation. SU2. Where x1 is minus 1 is going to be spin down, spin up, and x1 divided by 2 is just, you know, a spin. So I think I might have got a normalizing factor wrong. In the spin half representation, the Pauli matrix acts by plus and minus a half. And we just see, because this is the point where x is 1 or minus 1, x1 acts by plus and minus 1. So there's a factor of 2 missing. But this is, you know, the correct feature for the spin half representation. Now, from this perspective, it's not completely obvious to figure out why the other two coordinates correspond to the other two Pauli matrices. But it follows from the algebra once you quantize the Poisson bracket. So more generally, so the spin n over 2 rep comes from S2 with area n, so let me normalize slightly differently here so that it matches the spin. So this can be, say, x1 divided by 2, and this goes between minus a half, sorry, n divided by 2. So as I move from one to the next, I sweep out something of unit area. And the corresponding values of x1, these are the eigenvalues of the Pauli matrix in this representation. So you see, the n plus 1 states of the representation are geometrically labeled by these like slices of the sphere. So as I said, there's an extremely beautiful story where this generalizes to any group and any representation, where the data of the representation is encoded in the parameters of the symplectic form. So here, the symplectic form just had one parameter, which was a spin. But if I took SU3, I would need to give you two parameters. And indeed, in that case, the corresponding manifold is of dimension, what is it of dimension? Whatever, it has two parameters. OK, so let's move on to discussing. Yeah, this is maybe not necessary to go into so much detail. I just think it's a fun piece of math. So let's move on to discussing what happens when I have a Wilson line. What's another the phase space? So I'm going to have some surface. This is my surface. Sigma is this. And at some point P, we have a Wilson line, which comes from a G action on a manifold M given by Hamiltonian functions mu A. So saying this is a Wilson line means the time component of the gauge field must couple to whatever lives on this manifold. So the action is like the Chern-Simons action level n plus the integral of the time component of the gauge field, or A, R gauge indices. Now, this integral only happens along a line at a fixed point. So if I solve the equations in motion to build a phase space, we vary A, we find N times the field strength of A is equal to a delta function at P times UA. So in other words, in the presence of the Wilson line, the gauge field gets some kind of source, which is, you know, certainly very reasonable. So the Hilbert space in the presence of a Wilson line will be obtained by geometric quantization of a phase space given by these equations. As an aside, I realized I didn't quite explain. Maybe I'll get to that in a bit, actually. So let's do an example. In U1 gauge theory, U1 Chern-Simons at level n, the Wilson line of charge n is trivial. Why? So we'll do this, we'll figure this out by analyzing the phase space. This is because it is trivial if there's a gauge invariant junction like this. There's charge N. This is charge zero, so it's nothing. And this is the junction. Now, such things are going to be the Hilbert space. So by the, you know, to figure out what can live at this junction, we can use the state operator correspondence. That tells us such junctions are equal to the Hilbert space on S2 with a Wilson line of charge N. Okay, everybody happy so far? So now we're going to, now we're going to use our analysis of the phase space to find that there is such a junction precisely when the charge is N, reproducing the kind of observational feature we saw when we studied quantization on the two torus. And as usual, I'm being very sloppy about factors of pi. So apologies for that. Phase space you want to look solve the equation N times the field strength is delta P times mu, where mu is the Hamiltonian generating the U1 action on the phase space for the Wilson line. But if we have a state of charge N, then mu is equal to N. So the equation is FA times N is delta P times N. And let me put the 2 pi i's in here. Now, this can be solved exactly because the integral of S2 of FA over 2 pi I is an integer. Okay. So in other words, if I put the Wilson line of some other charge, then you would have found an equation saying that this integral was k over n. So Wilson line of charge k. You'd have integral over S2 and we can solve this only if k over n is an integer. So I think I run a little faster, but so the reason for doing this is, like, for introducing this analysis. So we wanted to explain this funny feature that charges periodicity, and we've explained it by some topological feature of U1 models on the two sphere. So states like this, which have this non-trivial topological charge, are called monopoles. The basic example is the Dirac monopole in U1 in Maxwell theory. So what we've seen is that this funny periodicity of the electric charge is explained by saying that it can end on a particle of charge n can end on a monopole. States like this. Any other questions? And I'll want to try to move on to something that you're going to discuss a little more in more detail in the tutorials. So studying the Hilbert space in the presence of knots, so of Wilson lines, is useful to understand knot invariance. So why is this? Well, you can take some interesting knot. You can tell a real topologist by their ability to draw a non-trivial knot, and I'm not a real topologist, so I'm going to have to. It'll be. A real topologist wouldn't have to erase anything. Okay, whatever. You can take some interesting knot. That's not an interesting knot, is it? Anyway, and cut it. Maybe, for example, here I take a plane, then I have something else over there. So the knot on the left, the piece on the left will give me a state in the Hilbert space corresponding to Hirschhorn-Simons theory plus Wilson lines. So on the phase space, at least where I've made the cut, we're going to have insertions of Wilson lines every time a knot passes through it. So there's this really beautiful fact that it is possible to answer using the phase space, but tricky. And maybe there's other ways of thinking about it. So consider SU2 Trans-Simons theory with and the Hilbert space on S2 with four punctures, four Wilson lines. Then the claim is this Hilbert space is of dimension 2. So intuitively, why is this? This Hilbert space is the same as SU2 invariant junctions like where I have my four Wilson lines coming in. So that's the same as SU2 invariant states in four copies of the Hilbert space of a Wilson line. So in other words, it's like take C2 tensor C2, tensor C2, tensor C2, and I look for SU2 invariant elements. And this is two-dimensional. I don't know, is this last fact obvious to you guys? That it's two-dimensional? I mean, it's two-dimensional because by Schur's lemma, the dimension is the number of irreps in the tensor product of this with this. And there are two. There's the trivial and the adjoint. So if you think about like, how can I make a scalar out of these four expressions? You can contract them in pairs. There's three ways of doing that, but there's one relation. Okay, so accepting that this is two-dimensional, which is, from this perspective, an easy fact, although a more careful derivation would say, you know, the Wilson line is given by the two-sphere with area 1, and then you carefully study the phase space, unfortunately, that becomes a little complicated. So given this, we find that there's automatically some really interesting relation among the knot invariants associated to SU2. Now, so corollary consider the expectation value of Wilson lines, say fundamental Wilson lines, in SU2 gauge theory, So then, if we project to a plane, so I have so there's four crossings like this. Each of these gives me a state in the Hilbert space for S2 with 4 points. Just because each picture like that is just a way of filling in so since this Hilbert space is two-dimensional, there are relations. So these are called like the Kaufman bracket relations. Sometimes so I'll have to look up the coefficients. So the kind of relation you find is, let me see, sorry. It's roughly this kind of thing. Or a Q, something like. So roughly, I'm not getting things totally right. But you know such a relation must exist, roughly of this form, because of the dimension of the Hilbert space. So determining the precise relation using quantum field theory is kind of tricky. It was done in Witten's famous paper. But it turns out this relation is enough to prove that the Chern-Simons knot invariance for SU2 are equal to the Jones polynomial. Which was another famous knot invariant. So this argument is, so Witten has a famous paper called, I think, Quantum Field Theory and the Jones Polynomial from the 80s. This argument is from that paper. And I think Giuseppe was going to elaborate a little bit. So as I said, finding the precise coefficients is tricky, but if you think about, you can use quantum field theory in perturbation theory to get to, say, one loop, kind of like we did with the, with the Goldman bracket. For example, these guys might exchange a single gluon, and if you follow the color along that gluon, you can go up there and down there. So a careful analysis will lead to some relation like this. Okay.
Sorry, Philip. Hmm? These guys are like the tree-level finite diagrams, kind of like that, right? Because I have...
Which are like the tree-level...
The four crossings.
The crossings represent Wilson lines, right? Which are like these defects in the system.
You can't think of them.
And then this relation is going to come from saying, I study the partition function with some boundary conditions. I put boundary states there, and I fill it in each of the four different ways. And to study that partition function, I should study all kinds of Feynman diagrams like this. And those four partition functions are not independent. They have some relation between them. So,
is there a notion of like incoming, outgoing states or anything like that?
No, because in just because the fundamental representation of SU2 and the anti-fundamental representation are the same. So there's no distinction between, if I wanted to do SUN, then these would be directed orals. In fact, if we were to do SUN, we would get something much closer. We did this computation of the commutator of Wilson lines in SUN, and we saw, when they exchanged a single gluon, you got terms where they factored off like that. So if you were to do this computation for SUN instead of SU2, it would be very, very close to that at leading order in the coupling. That might have been a better way to go. SUN, doing SUN for in UN from way in N might have been cleaner. Okay, so I suppose this is the end of the course, except for your tutorial. I have a feeling it was not the most comprehensible course, but are there any questions for